Well, hello everybody, and welcome to our class on the secrets of the Empress. This class is going to be an interesting class compared to the ones we've done up until now. Up until now, everything has had a standard reference to a system of attributions and a system of knowledge that is pretty straightforward, to which there is little objection, to which there are few variations. These are things on which the esoteric community more or less agrees. I mean, there's always a small amount of disagreement, but the larger points are in agreement. This class, The Secrets of the Empress, will take us in a slightly different direction, because for the first time, the main secret we're going to be talking about is a kind of a profound parting of the ways between two quite different visions of the meaning of this one card. You may be aware that differences of opinion arise from time to time among magicians, and here is one of them. In esoteric tarot, there is an older form and a younger one. That is, one that came before and one that came later. And I would say probably that that will not cease to be the case. There will always be new versions of old things. Sometimes there is a big difference between them, and the challenge is to find a way to draw them together and to unify them in a single version again. The older form that we're going to be working with, the older form always can be called Hermetic Orthodoxy, the standard form that most people adhere to and have for a long time. The younger form we would have to call a kind of Hermetic Heresy. I suppose by definition, anything that departs from an orthodoxy is a heresy. So from that point of view, this is heretical. The heresy by orthodox standards is, a misstatement of fundamental principles. That's what we're going to have here. There will be those people who know a certain way of looking at this card and understanding her, which they will find very difficult to give up, and they'll be very loath to do so. They're going to think that the newer version is simply just a misunderstanding. Now, the orthodoxy by heretical standards is a failure. It's a failure of purity, and it's a failure of depth. From the heretical, the newer standpoint, the older group missed something. They took a direction, a wrong turning somewhere. We'll see if we can bring those two visions together in this class, and you'll see the difference between them, and I'll leave it up to you later on to discuss amongst ourselves whether or not you belong to one school or the other, or can find a way to reconcile them. I would say that for myself, and for the tarot school, well, I shouldn't even say for the tarot school, because oddly enough, Ruthann, who is half the tarot school, and me, who's the other half, sort of part company in this very way. I mean, Ruthann likes the orthodox approach, and I like the heretical approach. So I'm just going to say that I personally carry the banner of heresy. I guess you would all find that both amusing and predictable. Maybe amusing because it's predictable, I don't know. Anyway, what follows is going to be an explanation of the Empress in the form of two interpretations side by side, the older form and the newer form. And we're going to work with the attributions of the Empress, and sometimes we'll work with one and sometimes the other. So that's how we're going to work it. The first attribution, the first thing that comes to mind that we need to pay attention to, as always, is the name. And the name of this particular card is the Empress. And you remember, I think, that when we first began this course and we were talking about secrets, that all the secrets of a card lie in the name of the card. That's where you're going to find everything, eventually. They all refer back to that. And if you're going to reconcile two disparate points of view, that reconciliation will normally take place in the name. So this is an important quality to understand. So here we have it, the name, the Empress. I mean, what in the world does the Empress mean? Empress. This is actually a name for which there is really no explanation in the Hermetic Orthodoxy. They just don't really talk about it. Occasionally, you'll see some reference to it. In one source, they describe the Empress, or the power of the Empress, as the sovereign power of creative imagination. And by using the word sovereign, they sort of cover it briefly. The problem is that the Empress is more than a sovereign. A sovereign is a king, essentially, or a queen. A sovereign rules a country, or a domain. But the Empress is not a queen, and she does not rule a kingdom. She is imperial. An empire is not a kingdom. And the difference between the two, for those of you who had never really gave it much thought, and maybe just for the purposes of clarification, a kingdom has a tendency to have a unity of language, culture, history, and many other things. There's a kind of morphological unity to a kingdom, even when minority groups are included in it. An empire is polyglot. An empire is a combination of many kingdoms, of many languages, many ideas, many of them contradictory and opposed to each other. And the empire somehow brings these disparate, separate, sometimes warring groups together under a single banner. It's a hegemony. And a hegemony is a universal rule. And the Empress is a ruler over rulers. This is the difference. There are four queens in Tarot. Each one rules their own kingdom. The Empress rules the entire universe of Tarot. The interesting question, though, is, and this is, I think, it's a particularly interesting question, in the universe of Tarot, at this point in its development, remember, we've only talked about four major arcana cards altogether. This is the fourth one. So there's only been three before it. So in this universe of Tarot at this point, what empire does the Empress have to rule? I mean, where are the prior kingdoms that she unifies under one command? So far as I can tell, the totality of experience contained in the major arcana to date consists of just the Fool's freedom, the Magician's power, and the Priestess's mystery. Just those three. But the interesting thing is that in those three is the secret of the Empress's empire. Those things together, each one of those three, freedom and power and mystery, each one of those is original. That is, each one of those comes from the same origin, from the same place, very high at the top of the Tree of Life. Each one is an independent and unconnected kingdom. Freedom goes in one direction. Power goes in a different direction. Mystery is yet a third direction, and each and every one of them goes its own way. Each of them is sovereign. Each moves away from the other and needs nothing from any of the others. The interesting thing is that if you left each of these three to themselves, they actually lead to three separate universes, not one. They would fall apart. They would disappear from each other, like railroad tracks that went at an angle, starting from a central point and extending outwards at an angle into an infinite universe. The further they went on their own path, the farther from each of the others they would get, until finally they had nothing in common whatsoever. The Empress is called the Empress because with her, you have the first experience of hegemony, the first experience of universal rule, the experience of bringing together and holding together each one of these three original potencies in one single empire that we call creation. Do you have any idea how powerful that is? It's absolutely spectacular. Normally speaking, we don't give the Empress that sense of awe that comes with the rule of the whole entire universe, that sense of holding together things that would otherwise fall apart. But there's another question that comes up out of this. It's an entirely separate issue, and that is, and it's something that I think would interest a lot of people to know, why is this first experience of hegemony, the first experience of universal rule, why is it feminine? Why does the Empress come before the Emperor? Why is the power of the feminine preeminent? And the answer is actually simple, and a little bit surprising, perhaps. It may be something you will have thought of, and perhaps not, I don't know. The first condition of an empire, the very first thing that an empire is and needs to be, is something that brings its parts together. Remember that the parts of an empire initially are independent. They're sovereign. Sovereign nations, sovereign countries, sovereign cultures, sovereign ideas, sovereign energies do not yield to each other. They exist like things that bump against each other and can't possibly interconnect. Oftentimes they're at war. So the very first job of an empire is to bring disparate parts into a unity, where they owe allegiance, loyalty, and all of those things to one central power. And then once they're brought together, usually by some form of conquest, they have to be held together. So that's what an empire does. It brings its parts together, and then it holds them together. And from this perspective, and I say from this perspective because there are others, but from this perspective, empire is essentially a container. It's a form, not a force. It's the energy of inclusion. And in this form, its basic nature is feminine and not masculine. So guys, I want to find out from you whether or not you feel that the idea of empire as feminine is an easy concept to come to terms with, or whether it sits uncomfortably with you. David, what's your feeling about that?
That it's a container?
Mm-hmm. Do you find it comfortable to think of empire as feminine?
No, I don't find it uncomfortable at all. I think the thing is, the way you're explaining it puts it into context, and I think that it feels right.
Good.
I mean, if you can think of the universe as a container of all life, then you have to think of this as being a feminine situation.
Yeah, well, now, the reason I ask you whether you found it comfortable or uncomfortable, and I'll ask the rest of you this as well, is because a lot of times empire is understood to be created by force, held together by force, and force in that sense is quite masculine. And that's the kind of thing you expect a conqueror to do. And there is that aspect of it too, which we'll come to later. But the form, the idea of an empire, is a feminine idea. Peggy, how does that feel to you?
Oh, that's perfectly comfortable, because it makes me think of Bina.
Yeah.
Which is form, which is female, which would be, again, the form of the empire.
So you don't find any problem in the idea that the empress should, by rights, come before the emperor?
Oh, absolutely not.
I thought maybe not. So let me ask, Tricia, how do you feel about that?
It sounds fine.
Now, you know, the interesting thing is that this is a card. It is a picture on a piece of paper. When you draw this picture to do a reading with, you want to have some idea of what it's about. And you need to have a starting point. Granted, there's a lot of things that you could say about the Empress, as there are a lot of things you could say about every card. But the place to start with any card is its name. And here we have this imperial figure who rules the universe, who rules all the disparate parts of it, who holds it together, binds it together, keeps it together, makes it a unity instead of a bunch of parts floating off into space separate from each other. That's the first thing that I would want you to be aware of, its binding power. And when the Empress comes up, you know that a number of different things are being held together by main force. Several things that would not have anything much to do with each other, several things that might in fact be at war with each other, will find themselves somehow or other kneeling before a single throne and accepting a single authority. That's, I guess, the implication of the name for a reading. I want to draw that out and make it clear, because it might not be so easy to see, you know, in all the verbiage. Myra, is that something that makes sense to you?
Yes. And it actually feels, I don't know, very natural, the word that comes to mind.
Good. Natural is actually exactly what it should be. We're going to get to the issue of naturalness in a moment when we get to the question of number. Does anybody, by the way, have any questions about this issue of empire and femininity? Reese, what about you? Does this all fit comfortably into your picture of things?
Oh, yes.
Good. By the way, you should be aware, once again, before we go any further, that all the things we're going to say here are forms and forces that could be found inside of you. So what I want you to do when you pay attention to the card as a divinatory tool is to recognize that the force of whatever card we're talking about is inherent in you as a reader and equally inherent in the querent. So if it comes up, it's talking about that part of a querent which does this, which feels this, which exerts this power and sees the world in this particular way. That's what I want you to remember. All right, well, I'm going to go on to the next issue, the next attribution, which is the number, before we do a reading, because it'll be kind of interesting to see. Yeah, go ahead, Cynthia.
Is the Orthodox or the heretical view of things?
I would say that it's more heretical in the sense that the older version of things paid little or no attention to the name, oddly enough, at least in this case. They don't say much about it. They don't make much of an issue out of it. So it's not that they disagree. It's just that, you know, it's like almost a non-existent issue for them. The only reference I've ever seen to the imperial aspect of the Empress is that one reference to the sovereignty of her creativity. And that's usually in another context.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that simply the act of paying attention to the primacy of name is by itself an aspect of the younger version of things.
Yet it gave her, in my mind, she was always more, I don't know, Queen of Cupsy or Queen of Pentacles. Like, now I see her more with her swords and her wands.
Well, the interesting thing is that you are then...
Put a different slant on
we're going to, yeah, we're going to be exploring why it would be that you would apply the issues of cups and pentacles to her. And remember that each of those is a kingdom in its own right. Each one of the suits is its own separate, independent monarchy. The main thing about the name is that the Empress unifies and rules all the queens. And in fact, not just the queens, all of everything. The queens, the kings, the knights, and the pages all come under her sway.
Monarchy.
Yeah, all the whole entire minor arcana comes under her authority, which is different than a queen by a long stretch. And I would say that that is essentially a modern view, a newer view, and perhaps a heretical view, although I never actually saw any of the older forms argue with it, and maybe if they had thought about it, they wouldn't have any argument with it at all. And with that, I'm going to introduce the second attribution of this class, and it's the most difficult one by far, and that's the issue of number. And in the question of number, we find the real beginnings of a separation between the older and the newer forms. It's an important difference. It's a difference, in fact, over which much argument can be expended and much heat can be generated. And I'm curious to see, when we get a chance to talk about it, how you each feel about it. So the number here, of course, is 3. The number of the card is 3. This is what is called a key number. In Hermetic Orthodoxy, the numbers of the major arcana combine, as you probably know. They can be added together, for example, as they would be here. They can also be multiplied by each other. And in this combination of mathematical or arithmetic qualities or functions, they get all kinds of esoteric results. And they love to make combinations and permutations, and that's the way you do it with number. So, for example, what is most commonly described about the number 3 is that it is a combination of the number 1 and the number 2. That is, the magician and the high priestess give birth in their numerical qualities to the high priestess as the form of the number 3. It can be said, from their point of view, that the Empress arises as a sum of the qualities of those things that went before it. It's very important. Hermetic Orthodoxy finds this to be one of the sources of its own many secrets, and it develops many a secret from it, and of course this whole course is about the issue of secrets in tarot, and that's one of them. It should also be noticed that, beginning with the magician and going all the way to the chariot, there are 6 attributions of styles of awareness given to the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. I guess there's seven such attributions. You may remember that the magician had the style of awareness that was called attention. And attention has all sorts of implications. You can do all kinds of things with attention, and we did talk about that. But the magician's attention is then said to be added to the high priestess's awareness of memory. She is given the function of memory, holding all the records of everything past, present, and future, knowing all that there is to know, and being able to bring to mind whatever we need to know from that stored memory. In fact, it is from those memories that we develop the idea of her mystery, that she knows literally everything. She's the storehouse, the bank, the database of all of creation. And it's said that when you add the attention of the magician to the memories, the collective memories of the priestess, between the two of them, they produce the creative imagination that is the hallmark of the Empress. That's the awareness style of the Empress. Imagination, more specifically, creative imagination. And so the number three gets to be the symbol for multiplicity. Multiplication, even. That idea produces the picture that you see on the card. It's the essence of the state of pregnancy. The number three is understood to be pregnant. That's the big deal. And that's the direction that Hermetic Orthodoxy takes. It doesn't make any difference whether you're working with the earlier Golden Dawn figures, or Crowley, or Waite, or Paul Foster Case, or any of the later people. This is what they see when they look at the number three, and when they look at the Empress. And that's why, in the Waite deck especially, I'm not so familiar with the other ones, but in the Waite deck, which is my specialty, the priestess is shown as pregnant. That, oddly enough, comes from this understanding of number. So, you could, if you wanted to, make a case for this use of number. I mean, it's not wrong. It's one way of looking at it. And you could also make a case for using types of awareness as a separate attribution. And there's no harm in that either. It actually leads to interesting things, as you see. The interesting thing, however, is that you could go in quite a different direction if you wanted to. In our Hermetic heresy, and I mentioned this to you earlier in earlier classes, the numbers of the major arcana are not meant to produce meaning. They're meant to create order. They're meant to create sequence, not meaning. The numbers are linked together, not combined. One is followed by two, is followed by three, is followed by four. One is never added to two. Two is never multiplied by three. That kind of thing doesn't happen in the newer form. The newer form is actually a bit purer and simpler. The numbers are meant to tell us where in the universe we are, not what we are. They don't define, they locate. The number three comes after the number two. It tells us something about the nature of things. It tells us that, if you want to think of the priestess as mystery, it tells us that mystery comes first, and empire comes second. And that's the proper order in which the universe is created. That's the order in which things need to be understood. That's the order in which things arise. It's a very important thing to know. You can't really know the proper nature of a thing unless you know where it stands in the order of things. That's what it does for you. Still, in the end, adding and linking produce results that are fairly similar. We kind of arrive at the same destination in the end. Even though the actual journeys are different, we get to the same place. The borders of the Empress's empire are, the number two on one side, which is the mystery of the High Priestess, and the reason of the Emperor on the other side, that's the number four. And in between these boundaries, which is the number three, you find the cauldron in which the whole potential of creation cooks. In between mystery and order, in between priestess and emperor, the universe cooks. This is the empire that's like a purse from which all future wealth of every conceivable kind is taken. This is the loom on which every design is ultimately woven. And it comes in between mystery and order. And thereby lies a secret. Therein lies something to ponder, something to contemplate. I could conceivably go on quite a bit about why it is and how it is and what it means that this issue of creation, the boiling of something in a pot, the weaving of something on a loom, why that should come between mystery and order. But I will actually leave that in your hands to do if you should ever wish to do it. It's worthy of pondering. Everything. Everything that has color and shape, everything that has sound or texture, everything that has a scent or a taste, arises here. But it doesn't arise in its final form, only as potential. What you have with the Empress is an endless medley of possibility. Hers is the empire of the possible, the potential. What will finally arise in real form, but has not yet arisen, only possible, only potential. That's also something to remember. Whenever you're working with the Empress, and if the Empress comes up in a reading, whatever is going to happen because of her will happen somewhere down the line. It hasn't happened yet. It's only possible now. She makes something possible that never was before. I should tell you how powerful, if you haven't already figured it out, how powerful a power that is to open the faucet of possibility. Realize that before the Empress, nothing is possible. The faucet is closed, no water is running, the well is dry. So the Empress opens up the flow of possibility. Think to yourself of how many times and how many ways you have brought yourself at one time or another to that moment where you need possibility. If you didn't have new possibility, the world would come to an end. How many times have you thought to yourself you need a new relationship, a new job, a new place to live, a new set of circumstances? You can't imagine what that would be to begin with. All you know is that the old has come to an end. It's a dead end, and you need to change it. And you feel desperate sometimes to do so. It's the Empress that opens up the spigot of possibility and allows you to begin to see where things might lead from here. She is the harbinger of the future. That's a really powerful thing to know. And all of this comes out of this issue of number, where she is between mystery and order comes the universe of possibility. I would like to know whether this idea ever occurred to you or not in the context of the Empress. I mean, all of you are pretty sophisticated. Most of you have been doing readings for a long time. And I want to know whether this idea is a new one or an old one. So let me ask a couple of people who we haven't talked to before. Let me see. Maris, what is your feeling about that?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, here's the idea. I'm just giving you the idea that the Empress is the opening of possibility, that she's the freshness. She's not a new beginning, because nothing has actually begun yet. She's pure potential. She makes it possible for something to actually come next. And I want to get a sense, first of all, whether that's something you ever associated with the Empress before.
No, it's not.
And having heard this, does it sound unreasonable or unlikely?
No, it sounds very reasonable. Unlikely.
If you drew the Empress as a card and you came across one of those situations that I was just describing where a person had reached the end of a road, was stuck, and really kind of desperate to move forward, but had no idea how or where or what, and the Empress were pulled. Would that be, in your opinion, a hopeful sign?
Yes.
That's the idea. That's what I want this card to begin to produce for you. And it comes out of the issue of number. Where in the hierarchy of things, where in the order of things, the Empress's power lies.
Can I ask a question here?
Sure.
You know, the thing is, she's continually pregnant. She's never giving birth to anything, really. She's just there, and you said it's a possibility. Is she compared to the fool who's taking that first step but never puts his foot down?
No, the fool actually is always putting his foot down.
He was in the process of putting his foot down.
What you actually see when you look at the picture is the moment just past when his foot has come down and the cliff has risen to meet his feet. You see the actual result of his having put his foot down.
Okay, and she's in the process of giving birth. She hasn't given birth.
Now, the interesting question here is, how do you reconcile, or do you find any difficulty in reconciling the idea of arriving at the number three by moving step by step from two to four and coming to three in the process, as compared to adding 1 + 2 to equal 3? Because the adding of 1 + 2 to equals 3 is what gives you the idea of multiplicity and pregnancy. The idea of moving in a sequence, in a proper order, like a well-ordered dance, like a minuet, from one state of awareness to another, without mingling or mixing, simply moving in the proper sequence, gives you the issue of freshness, originality, and the potency of potential. Are they the same thing? The question is a difficult one because it's not necessarily easy to separate. Maybe they're the same thing. They certainly seem to arrive sort of at the same general area. Pregnancy as the possibility of something about to be born and the potential for something to happen could sort of look more or less the same. No? What do you think, Paul?
I guess it could be the same.
Do you get a sense of any difference beginning to emerge here? I mean, my sense is that it's at this point that the heresy and the orthodoxy begin to part company.
Yeah.
It hasn't really, the separation isn't complete yet, but it's a place where if you deal with the theory rather than the end result, you can get a lot of argument.
Yeah.
And so far, the two of them seem to end up in a place similar enough where the argument can be put aside in favor of practicalities. I mean, pregnancy or potential, who cares? You know, they're just different words for the same thing. But I want you to be aware that at this point, things are beginning to move asunder. So far, though, they're okay. Now,
the Orthodoxy would say she was giving birth to creation, right?
They could say that. Yes.
Okay, but the thing is, the heresy would say she was pregnant. She hadn't given birth to anything yet.
Actually, the heresy doesn't even mention pregnancy. And you'll see that in the very next attribution when we deal with Venus. But up until this point, saying nothing more, all we're saying is that there's a big difference between taking the numbers 1 and 2 and blending them together by way of addition so they create between them a third number. In other words, 3 is not a thing by itself from the Orthodox position. 3 is a combination of two things that produce a third thing. And this idea of two things getting together to produce a third is where the idea of pregnancy comes from. But the idea of simply marching along at a good clip, going from point A to point B to point C to point D, and on each step along the way, a new aspect of creation arises, that's a different thing. The difference between a march and a sitting down. Pregnancy tends to be still. When one is pregnant, one doesn't move around much. One tends to be limited in one's movement in order to give birth to something else. The pregnant woman becomes a vessel. The pregnant source becomes a container and a protector and a nurturer of what's to come, and more or less exists for the purpose of giving birth. But in the marching order of things, the march is triumphant. The march is firm, the step is firm, the energy is strong, and the energy is forward. And there's no sense of lying down on the job at all. There's no sense of being, how would I describe it, a tool of what's to come. You are the becoming. And the difference between the two is between passive and active, or between a more passive and a more active role, I think. That's the sense that I have. I'm going to leave that open. I'm not going to try and convince you of that. It's my personal predilection to see it that way, and you may see something quite different. All I want you to be aware of is that here begins the possibility of argument. I'm going to do one more attribution before we begin to do readings, which I think may begin to clarify it, because at this third attribution, which is the astrological attribution, that's where the argument between the two sides becomes thick and heavy. The astrological attribution of the Empress is Venus. A very, very interesting planet to find in this place, in the order of things, to find her here. Hermetic orthodoxy is responsible for creating the order of the major arcana. They're also responsible for assigning the astrological attributions and the order of those attributions to the majors. It's a big, big responsibility. In doing it, and finding the right places to assign the planets and the signs and the elements, they achieve actually a picture of the universe which has withstood the test of several hundred years of time and a lot of probing, and has given tarot a good chunk of its meaning and its power. So when I say that the Hermetic Orthodoxy gives this goddess to the Empress, it's a major gift. The interesting thing about it is that it turns out that it's more of a default setting than a gift. You probably know that there really is only one planet of the seven of ancient astrology that is named for a feminine goddess, you know, for a goddess instead of a god. There is another planet which is considered to be feminine, and that's the moon. But those are the only two. All the others are masculine. Now, the moon, you know, has already been given to the High Priestess. And all the other feminine characters in the major arcana, like strength and the star and the world, all of those characters have already been given assignments. The world has been given to Saturn. Strength was given to Leo, at least in the weight deck. Libra was given to Justice, if you think of Justice as feminine. All of them have already been given their places. They're either signs, or they're the planet Saturn. So what's left? We've got Venus to deal with. Venus has obviously got to be given to a feminine character in the major arcana. And the only one left after all the assignments was made was the Empress. And so Venus goes to the Empress by default. The quality of creative imagination that we talked about before, which was derived from adding 1 + 2 to get 3, that's where you get the image of pregnancy and motherhood. That's where the source of it is. And that image of pregnancy for the Empress is essential to the Orthodox understanding of the Empress. That's how they see it. And they're willing to stake their life on that particular fact. That's what the Empress is about. So, because the Empress is stuck with Venus, it sort of makes it necessary for Venus, which is a general symbol of womanhood, to express the qualities of pregnancy and motherhood. Even though, I'm sure you will all be aware of this fact, some of you are probably very familiar with astrology, you will probably then be aware that neither astrology nor mythology assigns the idea of motherhood or pregnancy, particularly to Venus. That's not who she is. The goddess Venus is the symbol of half of the power of the feminine. And that's the power of sexual allure, the power of flirtation and love and passion. Not in the least the other half of pregnancy and motherhood. Now, Ruth Ann and I have had our debate on this, because one of the things that the Orthodox community of Hermeticism has done is to say that Isis and Venus combine here in this card, that Isis is a mother goddess. Isis is Mother Nature, or certainly has qualities like Mother Nature. She's responsible literally for the birth of the world. And they give Isis to Venus as a pair, as though Isis and Venus were in some way the same thing, just from different pantheons. The fact is that is not true. Isis is in no way Venus. Isis is a mother. Isis is a producer. Isis is a pregnant woman. Isis is the mother of Horus. Isis is the wife of Osiris. That's what she was. That's what she did. That was her reason for being. Although Venus was married, she was never a happily married woman. She had lovers all over the place. Her whole life was filled with lovers. And she had children, but not because she particularly wanted them. They just kind of happened, the way that kind of thing happens when a woman sleeps around. Her power was in her beauty, not her maternal qualities. The Empress in our heresy is Venus. And in our heresy, Venus is the all-conquering power of the feminine. The all-conquering power, not of pregnancy and motherhood, but of attraction. She's the irresistible magnet of beauty. And that magnet draws everything together and holds it together, which is what we said empire is supposed to accomplish. And sometimes it's hard to understand exactly what that means. Let me give you a kind of an example. Well, I'll give you, first of all, a statement that might help to clarify it, and then I'll give you an example which will clarify it even more. In the presence of Venus, all the other energies of the universe stop what they're doing, and they all kneel at her feet. To win her approval, they'll perform any task she sets them because she's so beautiful. She paints a picture of possibility with her imagination so beautiful that no one has the power to resist it. Have you ever seen a movie or read a novel or a story in which a beautiful woman holds court and all the men at the salon or all the men of the court kneel at her feet and wait for a simple glance from her eyes or a smile from her lips? They dance attendance on her and will do anything she wants just for a little tiny bit of a smile. A knight will wear a beautiful woman's colors on his arm when he goes to his own death. He'll do it for her sake. He'll undertake the most gallant tasks of heroism for the sake of the beauty of a woman. That's the power that Venus has. She has the power to bring all other energies to her side to do what she wants with. She's absolutely supreme. Once upon a time, there was no tarot school. In the end of 1994, I was working as a volunteer in an organization in New York that was a holistic learning center, which a lot of people had gone to. It had a big name and reputation, and it routinely would give lectures and classes in tarot. Teachers would come from around the country, people that we all know, authors, scholars, and authorities in tarot would come, and they would give a weekend workshop, perhaps, or they might give a six-lesson class, maybe 2 hours a lesson. And then after they had done that, they would always pitch these things to beginners because that's who they were basically looking at, they would go away. And then sometime later, another teacher would come by and do a similar short session or short class, and they would go away. And over and over and over again, this pattern would repeat itself. And the result was that there were a lot of people who found tarot fascinating but had nowhere to go to learn any more. They were always being given another teacher's vision that was kind of pre-chewed and pre-digested for the purpose of teaching beginners. So they never got past the stage of being a beginner. Now, this was a long time ago, and things have improved since then. But that was the way things stood at the time. And Ruth Ann and myself and another couple of people that we knew at this place said, you know, there's got to be people out there who would like to do better than that. We should get together maybe and practice with a group of people. We should get together and maybe have a group that would meet and learn a bit more. That was the first vision. But you know what? For me, that wasn't a powerful enough vision. I wanted something better than that. I think it was me that proposed a school. I don't remember if it was. Hard to say now. But I wanted to actually do this. I wanted to create a real school, make a business out of it. And the other three people said, well, I don't know, I don't think so. It doesn't look like that has much possibility to me. And being a kind of visionary salesman, I painted them a picture of grandiose possibility. I showed them the possibility of doing psychic cruises and big parties and working at political conventions and, oh, doing all sorts of amazing and wonderful things. And you know what? After a while, my vision of that possibility was so entrancing that all the other three joined me in a venture that initially they thought didn't have a prayer. I sold them on it. I painted them a picture so pretty they couldn't resist it. And so they gave it a shot. Two of them fell away, and Ruthann and I continued on. But we continued on under the assumption that our beautiful picture, our potential of magnificence, would eventually result in a reality. And so we put one foot in front of the other. We persevered through thick and thin. We lasted so far for 11 years, and we're still holding out the possibility of wonderful, great, huge, unimaginable, paradisical, fantastic possibilities coming out of the work that we do. Well, of course, that remains to be seen. But we have persevered all the way through this time because of that vision. It was a beautiful vision. And we marched to that vision. And something was born of that vision and continues to this day. I don't know how many of you have ever been swept off your feet by a charismatic political candidate who promises you wonderful things in the future. I don't know how many of you have been swept away by an artistic vision or by the possibility of a great financial enterprise, maybe something entrepreneurial that has captured your imagination and made you willing to try something that common sense tells you is not a good idea. This is essentially what the Empress does. She paints a picture of such beauty that you can't resist it. And you'll do what you can to make her vision real. And out of her vision, out of her imagination, and out of the beauty of her picture, worlds are born. Empires are born. And you can look around in this country and see how many times that has happened and how many times it will happen yet. And that's the power of the Empress. That's the power of beauty. That's the power of allure, the sexual attraction of possibility. It's so powerful that nobody can resist it. Given that, given Venus as the power of beauty and the ability of beauty to command loyalty, attention, and unity, do you still see the Empress is pregnant? Is that what a mother does? It's a question. Now, that's actually going to be a real question. It's not going to be an academic one. It's not going to be a half a one. All right, so let me ask you, Reese, do you grasp the sense of the power of beauty?
Yes, I do.
That's all I wanted to know. Margie, I haven't asked you yet, but have you ever found yourself succumbing to a beautiful idea?
As listening to you talk about the Tarot School, I can.
Have you never felt swayed? Have you never felt attracted? Have you never felt driven to take chances by somebody who painted for you a beautiful picture of possibility?
That's never happened, to be honest.
That's really interesting. Well, one day perhaps it will, and you'll find your whole life will be transformed.
I sure hope so.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, how many of you here ever saw the movie Elmer Gantry?
Mm-hmm. Long time ago.
Yeah, well, it was a long time ago.
I read the book.
Yeah, well, Elmer Gantry, of course, was a charismatic preacher.
Requirement, I think.
That's right. Well, Elmer Gantry was a charismatic preacher, and he got people to do the most awful things because he was an absolutely fabulous speaker, and he just projected brilliance and beauty from his smile. He made you want to do what he wanted. And he produced all kinds of interesting results from nothing more than his charisma, literally from his beauty. That's the kind of thing that can happen, and it happens all the time. Anyway, I just wanted you to be aware of that. Now here we are at the halfway point of the class, and I would like to begin to find out whether we can answer some questions with this idea.
Walt?
Yes?
I just want to say the Keatsian line, beauty is truth, truth, beauty.
Yes, and the power of truth is enormous. And truth and beauty, by the way, in this case, are exactly the power of the Empress. That's exactly her empire.
You know, isn't that funny? I was just going to ask if beauty sometimes wasn't illusion, that within that concept of beauty was a concept of illusion. It sells, but it may not necessarily sell what really is.
Well, you know, whether a thing is real or isn't real is not the concern of the Empress. Reality is a long way past the boundaries of her empire. Reality doesn't really set in until the bottom of the heap, until the last card has been laid on the table. That's when reality finally sets in. So you can't judge what the Empress's power is by issues of reality. That's an interesting thought all by itself and deserves another whole story, another whole lecture.
But if her empire is the entire Minor Arcana, then she's both illusion and truth.
Her empire is the whole deck, Cynthia.
Whole deck.
Her empire is the whole deck, which means, if we understand her correctly, if we understand the deck, which means everything. The deck is a picture of the world as it is. The deck is a picture of all of its possibilities. Everything
right.
that's hidden and everything that ultimately is revealed is real. That's the whole deck. And so the Empress rules that whole entire thing. So anyway, what we're going to do is Ruth Ann is going to draw a name. And that person, if they wish to, will ask us their question. And then, using the issues of name, number, and astrological attribution, just those three, of empire, of the order of things, of beauty, of creativity, of supreme power, of possibility, and the beauty of a thought or an idea or a picture painted, to answer a question that somebody asks. So, Ruth Ann, who do we have?
We have Myra.
My question is this a good time to change jobs, or is this a good time to look for a different job?
Okay. Is this a good time? Okay, we want to know, presumably, I'm going to clarify, I'm going to work on that question a little bit to clarify.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, you would feel that at some point you would like to change, just not sure if this is the right time. It's an issue of
Correct.
Timing. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Good. That's what we're talking about now. So what I would like to do is I would like each of you to give a moment of thought to how the issues of the Empress that we've talked about so far will have a bearing on answering this question. Should she do it now? Should she wait? And remember that we have drawn the Empress as a one-card answer to her question.